Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Joe Alton from Doom and Bloom. We're talking about emergency medicine if help isn't available, especially in the coming global heat. Now, the other thing that you mentioned in that video that interested me is there are certain temperatures at which the person is no longer sweaty. They don't look hot necessarily. They may be dry looking. Now,
you're absolutely right. You know, at about 106 degrees of Fahrenheit, which I think would be 30. You'll have to let me know.
I'm not sure either. We'll go with the Fahrenheit.
Okay, we'll go with the Fahrenheit then. Sounds good. My apologies to our friends in Europe and Australia. But once you hit 106 degrees Fahrenheit, your body loses the ability to use sweating as a mechanism to eliminate excess heat from the body. And so once that happens, the skin is hot, but it's dry. If you actually go into shock, your skin could become cold and clammy, actually, but a body core temperature will reveal the truth that you are over, say, 106 degrees. And sometimes people go all the way up to 110 and do survive it, 110 degrees Fahrenheit, but sometimes they don't.
So it is possible to die of heat stroke.
Yes, indeed.
Well, some of our listeners believe climate change is coming, and if the electricity goes out, you've got no air conditioning. You're going to have to figure out a way to cool off. So that's one thing that you cover, but you cover a lot more than that, and you provide the materials and also the lists for people to be prepared for an emergency. Do you want to talk about your medical packs and also whether people can just use the lists without buying the medical pack?
Yeah, actually, the funny thing about our mission is that I could care less if I sell any of our medical kits, even though we have an entire line of medical kits that go from a 1 pound, 1.5 pound hiker, biker kit, that type of thing, to all the way to a large, full backpack filled with the ability to deal with multiple episodes of traumatic injury. We freely publish all the contents of every single pack that we have. And the reasons why we put things in those individual packs, because we want people to have the items that are in those packs. We don't care whether they have a pack that comes from our design, let's say. We just want them to have lots of medical supplies so that we freely publish those. We want people to take a look at that and see how it would make sense for them. And we want them to work with it in such a fashion so that the way they pack it makes sense for them. I mean, can you reach things that you need for a particular injury easily? And can you accustom yourself to putting together a pack that is organized for you and that you can act quickly with? That's the most important thing, to be able to act quickly.
Well, people stock up on food. They may stock up on self-defense, but they probably don't have enough bandages or any of those things, and they feel that they don't need to. They'll dial 911.
Well, I think that is pretty short-sighted. And, you know, I know a lot of people are all about the beans and the bullets, but we are all about the bandages. And one thing I'd like to just relate to people, and this is really, really important, that you could never, ever have too many medical supplies. No matter how many people that you think that you're going to be responsible for in times of trouble or in a homestead community, there's always going to be more people that are going to knock on your door and may ask you for medical help, especially if they're aware that you have medical skills and that you have put together supplies. So always have more than you think you need. Remember that in any time of trouble, that excess medical supplies will be extraordinarily valuable barter items.
You know, I'm looking at this. I don't have any medical skills to speak of. I might be able to do CPR in an emergency. That's about it. So I've got a lot to learn. You must have figured out what the average person could learn. Is that what you put in your book? And if so, tell us about that.
Yes, you're absolutely. Not only do I write everything in plain English, and I essentially tell people strategies that I believe are relatively easy to remember, that can be step by step, and give them some clear indications of how they can identify some of the most common things that you would encounter in a remote setting or in a situation where you can't depend maybe on, you know, sterilized water or clean food or properly prepared food. But we also do it in such a fashion that people can feel comfortable that they can be medically responsible person. It's all in plain English. It's all there. And the supplies that we talk about, how to use the supplies. And this is something that people really don't think that they have the potential to learn how to take care of other people, be medically responsible for themselves and for other people. But this is something that's very, very basic. And most of the issues that you can deal with medically in a disaster situation are things that are well within the non-medical professional's grasp. There are situations that are not going to be within the thoracic or trauma surgeon's grasp in some situations where the grid is down. You know, some chest wounds, things like that, are just not going to be survivable, or brain injuries are not going to be survivable, even with the best of skills. And we have to understand that, and I'm very realistic about that in the book as well. So I'm not suggesting to people that they're going to have miracle cures of major traumatic injuries, but I will want to give them the best chance of getting their patients to recover from survivable injuries.
Why aren't we taught these things in school? How did we come into a culture where we're so separated from looking after our own bodies?
Because we are in a culture in which we're not responsible for most of the services that we receive. We're not responsible for doing just about anything for ourselves anymore. And so as a result, when modern technology is available to us, you know, it's very easy for us to allow a small number of people to be in charge of that technology. And when they're in charge of that, a small number of people are in charge of these things, then other people feel that, well, we are actually in good hands. And you are. I mean, most of the people that take care of us, you know, medically, or have the best of intentions. I'm not saying that they don't, but I believe that it's just very important to take some responsibility yourself as well.
Yeah, I think as a parent, that would be one thing. And a lot of parents do. They try and get some little handbook that they can have on the shelf at least and recognize if this child is in serious need of help or not. It's something we should do as parents. Do you feel that you have been put in a fringe category because you're coming out and speaking out on this?
I have had some criticism from the medical establishment for what we're doing, but I really consider this to be a mission. And this mission is to allow people to have a chance to protect their family medically in situations where we cannot depend on medical help to be, or modern medical help to be, readily available. And there are many circumstances where that is the case, and we just don't realize it. As far as I'm concerned, I will say that I've actually had as many physicians support, you know, my views as I've had physicians criticize my views. As a matter of fact, many physicians are people that buy our medical kits. So I'm actually gratified to hear that from some. But from my standpoint, I really don't care if there is criticism. I really feel that it's important, very important, for people to become better medical resources for their families, for their loved ones in the event of disasters or in remote settings, because if you don't do it, then no one else will.
So please, Joe Alton, tell us the name of your book and your website so people can follow up.
The name of the book is The Survival Medicine Handbook, When Help Is Not on the Way. And we are at www.doomandbloom.net, and you'll find over 300 articles on medical preparedness absolutely free on the website.
I'm going to try and educate myself. Thank you so much for being on Radio EcoShock.
You're so welcome.
Woody Tash is a man who worked the finance industry and then reevaluated his life. He longed to find a way to stimulate the growth of local food sheds with local finance. That developed into his book, Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, Investing as if Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered. Here's my chat with Woody at the Mother Earth News Fair last June.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest here at the Mother Earth News Fair is Woody Tash. We're going to talk about slow money. Now, I don't very often have anybody who knows anything about venture capitalism on this show. We're going to talk about slow money, and the thing is that eventually we all might need some help, some investment, and we don't know where it's going to come from, and Woody's going to tell us a little bit about that. So Would you introduce yourself just a little bit? Let people know who you are.
Sure. Well, you got my name right. It's Woody Tash. About 6 years ago, I took a year off from what I was then doing, which was running a national investor network that was steering money to sustainable businesses. And I took a year off to collect my thoughts, I guess you'd say. And I did, and it came out as a book on slow money. And then for the last 4+ years, I've been trying to catch up with the idea. So, meaning we now have about 20 chapters in the U.S., one in France, about to have one in Australia. And these are just groups of people who are getting together with their friends and neighbors and starting to make small investments in food businesses near where they live, supporting organic food businesses and local food systems, which is really, pretty simple on one level. But in today's world, I guess it's not completely simple. And it's definitely different from venture capital. That's why I made the little crack about venture capital, which I'm not against per se. I'm just against thinking that's all there is. And this is another way to do investing in small private businesses.
All right. Well, that went by a little quickly for me because I think there's various stages to it. So let's deconstruct it a little bit here. So where does it start in this chain of things that you're talking about?
Basically, you didn't say what is slow money. So good that we don't have to start there, but we can go there if we need to. But if I just say things like, if we just talk about the money part of this, we're giving our money to people we don't know very well to invest in things that they don't fully understand halfway around the world in places most of us will never visit. Then you pause on that for a second and say, does that seem like a recipe for building a better future? And of course it doesn't when you say it like that. And that is not, to me, not too much of an oversimplification of what our financial markets have turned into. They're just gross abstractions with money zooming around seeking so-called risk-adjusted rates of return and who knows what, with derivatives being the most egregious abstraction. But that's only an extreme example of something that goes through the whole system. So we've got this very abstract financial system and all of our investment capital. If you have it in a bank or you have it somewhere, it's at least in part supporting that system, usually mostly supporting that system. So that's part of the it. That's the money part. And then the other part is the food part, which is what those of us in slow money feel is that a very concrete, specific thing we can do to take some of our money out of that crazy abstraction is to put it to work in something we understand near where we live. And there's nothing much more tangible than food. And so, it's not super high tech. It's not super complicated. These are small businesses that make our communities better. They're just not very profitable, which is the slow part, meaning we're not doing it to make a lot of money. We're doing it because we want to take some of our money away from something we don't believe in and put it into something we do believe in.
Okay. Could you maybe give us an example of one of the early projects that you helped support?
Oh, sure. So investing has been going on for a little over 3 years under this loose banner of slow money. And we're over $30 million now into over 220 small food businesses around the country, one in Europe, one in Switzerland. So this is everything from a couple of $1,000 loan to a farmer who needs a new piece of something or wants to buy a few chicks or whatever, but it's a small capital investment of some kind, all the way up to a few $1 million. And the largest investment was one person. Actually, just recently, a couple of weeks ago, invested $3 million in a milk cooperative in Maine from one investor. That was very unusual, obviously. The vast majority of them are small loans that two or three or four people team up on and maybe lend, let's say, $14,000 is one that jumps out and that sticks in my head for some reason to buy a cold storage truck for a delivery business in North Carolina. And four people teamed up and lent $14,000 between the four of them. So it's a lot of small things. And it's in all areas of the food system. It's everything from the individual producer all the way through. It can be processing, distribution, grain mills, creameries, slaughterhouses, restaurants that source locally. And if people are interested in hearing this and want to see examples, they can either go on the slowmoney.org website and see a bunch of examples there, or they can go to Slow Money Maine or Slow Money North Carolina. That's slowmoneync.org. And Slow Money North Carolina, Carol from that chapter is here speaking at the same event. She just published a book called Financing Our Food Shed. And she has personally, in the last 3 years, facilitated, I think she's up to 39 peer-to-peer loans in North Carolina to small food businesses totaling over $700,000. All of those loans are listed on the Slow Money North Carolina website, all of the entrepreneurs, what the business is, how much money they got. So it's a little of everything is the answer to your question. It's pretty much any small enterprise that's involved in food production, processing, distribution, or retailing.
I find this exciting.
It is exciting. It's actually it's at moments very inspiring. We just had our fourth national gathering in Boulder, Colorado a month ago. We had 650 people from 37 states and 5 or 6 countries there. But the inspiring part, well, that was partially inspiring, was how many people came and who they were. But We had 25 small food businesses presenting from that we picked from all over the country. And when you see those 25 entrepreneurs all present for 5 minutes, one right after the other on stage, it is extremely inspiring. I mean, it gives you hope that against all the odds, some good stuff could happen.
How do the four people in North Carolina, for example, find the person who has this need for the refrigeration truck to keep going? How does that happen?
We have this magician named Carol Pepe Hewitt who's matchmaking. In that case, that's one of the interesting things about slow money, especially if anyone listening knows anything about finance, you know that it tends to get pigeonholed into very narrow boxes. It's a this, it's a that, it's an equity thing. This is very diverse. I mean, so we have 20 some odd chapters and they're all doing things a little differently. And Carol in North Carolina is the one who's doing this peer-to-peer kind of magic show where she's actually matchmaking people who have money, people who need money. Doesn't work all the time, but she's spending most of her time just networking around the state of North Carolina. Now people know she's starting to get a little reputation, and people who have some money to put into the food system are starting to know she's there, and the entrepreneurs are starting to know she's there. I mean, I was going to say there's no magic. There is magic to it, but it's not a science. I mean, she is really just putting herself out there. Under the banner of slow money, we have something called the slow money principles, which is just it's a one-page set of ideas. The first one says we must bring our money back down to earth. I mean, it's very basic, but we have a vision that unites us. And other than that vision, as far as the deals go, it's everybody just finding each other and figuring out how they can help one another. So there's not like a simple answer to your question, but I'm proud to say she is doing it. The other chapters are operating a little differently. They have public meetings. They put on an event somewhere, 100 people show up, and they have a few entrepreneurs will come up on the stage and present some things to the people who are there. Sometimes they do it on a farm field. It might be a little bigger, like Northern California has done a few big ones where they have a big tent and 250 people show up on a farm. So it's a series of activities that are not uniform, but that are all doing the same thing, which is just connecting people and letting people, find one another.
Well, supposing I'm going to retire and I've got some money, I've got a little bit of money, and I want to put in $25,000. I believe in what you're saying. I want to cooperate with that. Am I going to get a return on my money?
Excellent question. I can't guarantee that you will. You might. I mean, we're making investments. So like any investment, you have to kind of figure out how risky you think it is compared to something else you might do with those same dollars. So the first thing I would say, you didn't ask it this way, but I'd say the first thing any financial person would tell you is get diversification. So if you have $25,000, if you're only going to put it in one thing and hope it works, that's probably not a great strategy. That's a basic, that's not special to slow money. That's any kind of financial dealing. So let's say give me a little more advice. I might say, if you live near a slow money chapter, that would be good. Then you could start going to the chapter meetings, meeting the entrepreneurs, meeting your other investors, getting an idea of what's out there. And then maybe patiently put that money to work over a couple of years in at least several different things, not all in one thing. So that's part of the answer. Most of the transactions are low interest loans. So if you said, how do these things work? Most of them, there's no one size fits all. We don't legislate it. It's up to people involved to figure it out. But most of them are loans of, let's say, 3%, 4%, 5%, often without collateral. So like these are things like no banker would ever do it like this. Sometimes the slow money chapters reduce the interest rate from what the entrepreneur asked for. In other words, we're doing this to help the entrepreneurs. That's the main reason we're doing these things. So the question of, can you be assured of getting all your money back plus the interest rate? You cannot be assured. There is no such thing as a free lunch or a sure investment, I guess. But I think we all believe if we do enough of this over a long enough period of time, we'll be happy with the performance and the combination of the financial returns and the benefits to the community that we're generating.
I'm reaching for the name of the small loan system that was developed in Bangladesh and spread throughout the developing world, where very small loans were made to, say, a woman who wanted to get a goat, etc. Does that have a relationship to what you're doing?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's Grameen Bank you're referring to. And it's a very high-profile example because it spawned the whole industry that's called microfinance now. And the basic idea there was a relationships between a group of people who live in a village, the reciprocity in those relationships was strong enough to actually reduce the risk of making small loans, even though bankers would never have done it. And Muhammad Yunus, the guy who did it, the economist who did it, actually, I think the first one was $47. It was some funny number like that, where he actually just took the money out of his pocket and made the loan, and it got paid back. And then he realized, wow, there's something here. So it's a very large number of really small loans. And I don't know what their averages are now. I don't track it currently, but I'd be surprised if their average loan was more than $500. I mean, I think it's a lot of very small loans. And there are websites now like Kiva.org, K-I-V-A.org, where individuals can go on. You can pick a small, like a micro entrepreneur in a developing country and lend them through Kiva $50, which they will batch together into, say, a $500 loan to give to the entrepreneur. So you're right to bring that up. What we're doing is, let's say, you could say is a kind of a U.S. analog or something, but it's larger because we're talking about businesses. We're not talking about like a cell phone entrepreneur in a village in a developing country. We're talking about someone who's got a diversified organic farm or a CSA or a processing business. Oftentimes, well, usually they need at least tens of thousands. Sometimes they need hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars. So it's definitely in another place in the financial continuum. But in the U.S., I don't think anyone knows the answer to this question. Is a $10,000 loan to a farmer a micro loan in the U.S.? Almost. I mean, in the U.S. economy, that's almost like a micro loan. Certainly a $5,000 loan might be called a micro loan. My hope is that we're going to show that the shared vision and local knowledge of investors will actually have a similarly salutary effect on the outcome from an arithmetic standpoint. But it's going to take us a while to show that. I mean, we're only 3 years into this, and I do think what we're doing is riskier than a $50 or $100 loan to one person in a village, because it's a more complicated business. You know, as I said, you know, getting, let's say, diverse, you know, growing a CSA, let's say, just take that as an example, community supported agriculture. It's a pretty complicated undertaking. You might have hundreds of customers, and it's a several hundred thousand dollar a year business, no matter what. It's just more complicated than a super, you know, just a, you know, so-called micro enterprise. So, but 10 years from now, we'll have all the data. Right now, we're all taking the risk. Those of us who are doing it are creating the data for everybody else to look at. You could call it a big pioneering demonstration project. But so thank you for bringing that up, because the Bangladesh experience was, let's say, the first part of the thread, and now we're kind of following it back to another place.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock, and we're at the Mother Earth News Fair. Our guest is Woody Tash. We're talking about slow money. Well, Woody, you have set up a nonprofit. Tell us what you personally do.
We're just kind of, blowing on the embers or spreading the seeds, whatever metaphor you want to use. I mean, I would say the main thing I've learned over the last 4 years is that there are, I believe, at least a few million Americans who want something like this to happen. And the first part of it is that there's just a need for an authentic, nuanced conversation about what's broken in food and finance. And a lot of times people who are so-called foodies or people who are in the food movement, they don't talk about finance that often. But as soon as you start having the discussion, it's like, oh, my God, of course. Because, you know, industrial agriculture is just the other side of the coin from industrial finance. I mean, it's the same. There's many ways to talk about it. You know, you can talk about, maybe the simplest is to say, compare GMOs to derivatives. And if you just think about that for a second, even if you're not sure what either one is exactly, you realize these are very complicated technical fixes to something where the fix is maybe apparent and superficial and maybe profitable for a while, but long-term it creates a big system problem. So what's broken in finance and what's broken in food are really two sides of the same coin. So part of what we do is just create space for that conversation. And, you know, we just kind of foment the conversation. And my book, Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, has been a catalyst for that conversation, which has been, of course, you know, really gratifying as the person who wrote the book. But as the person who has to be the steward of the conversation, it's pretty challenging, because it's a lot of people all around the country all wanting to, A, start talking, and then, B, start doing. So, to your point, our nonprofit is in the business of trying to help people get going in this. And then we're just connecting all the groups, and we have webinars and newsletter, and there are regional events, national events. We have ways of connecting everyone who's starting to do this so we can all learn together and hopefully enhance the how it proliferates and the outcome for everybody.
And that's slowmoney.org? Did I get that right?
Slowmoney.org. And most of the chapters have local websites, too. I mentioned a few. I would say Slow Money Maine and Slow Money North Carolina are two websites that are particularly full of interesting stuff. But if you go on the slowmoney.org site, you can connect through to any of the local. You know, we list all the locals there, too. So people, it's kind of a one place you can go to see everything.
Woody, some of my concerns and concerns that I hear from listeners in email is that the financial system is a large gambling ring that's kind of gone out of control, and you add to that the picture of national debts and municipals going bankrupt in some cases. It seems to me what you're doing, at the very least, even if somebody loses a little bit of money, we're going to end up with more of a local food supply, which is the basic supplement of life. Without that, we're not going to keep going. So is that part of your overall picture?
Of course. I mean, I love it when someone says, well, isn't what you're doing risky? And then I always say, well, risky compared to what? If you don't think it's risky having all your money in smokestacks in China, then just keep it invested exactly where it is. Seems pretty risky to me. I mean, our markets are extremely volatile and unpredictable, even though right at this moment as we're speaking, there's kind of this uptick going on. But there's no surety in any of that. And there's a lot that we could talk about there. To me, I do it for a more visceral reason than all that. I mean, there's a lot of left brain reasons you can come up with of why you should take money out of all that and put it over here. I just feel this compulsion to do something that I know in my bones is an immediate good thing. But I don't need an expert to tell me that it's a good thing to invest, to try to have more organic farms in my community and less toxics in the, you know, and more organic matter in the soil and more water in the aquifer and all these things. And to your point, as many, many observers going all the way back to Native Americans have said, you know, you can't eat money. So this idea that we would solve our problems through economic growth and technology by itself and not have to take care of the most basic elements of our survival, it's kind of seems kind of absurd at this moment. And I think there are more and more people getting to that understanding. But as long as you have the old investing template in your head, it's really hard to take your money out of the other system because that's where our 401ks are. That's where we've been taught that that's kind of the only way to manage your money. And if all you're thinking about is arithmetic during, well, let's say any one 10-year period, maybe that's still the best thing to do. If that's all you care about is having some idea of how your arithmetic is going to work in your portfolio and you don't want to think long term, I'm not going to try to talk you out of that. But for me and the people who are doing slow money, we just have this gut feeling that we're up against something much bigger than that. By the way, I should emphasize this. I haven't taken all my money. I don't know what to do any better than anybody else. I'm trying to take as much as I can and start doing this. But we sometimes say just start with 1% of your money. You know, just start with something and just make a move away from the bad stuff towards this. And then just find your comfort zone. You know, how much of your money, how much of your time you want to spend doing this. But it's definitely not about throwing the entire baby out with the bathwater. I wouldn't on some theoretical basis. But it is, going back to your point, very much about believing that a few tangible steps in our community towards more resilient food, more local food is a good thing. And we have to invest in it, in a sense, no matter what the financial return to us is immediately. And it's really important to add to this, Alex, that just because you can't quantify what the other returns are doesn't mean they aren't there. This is a huge thing. We live in this culture where everyone's worshiping at the... John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard Group, the largest asset management firm in the world, has $2 trillion in assets, wrote a book called Enough, in which he said we're worshiping at the altar of numbers. If I said that, people would think I was some wacko, right? But John Bogle says that it's okay. And just because you can't immediately measure, let's say, nutrient density in food or organic matter in the soil or food miles or this or that. And you can actually measure those things. But the individual person, I'm not going to hire an expert to measure all that to tell me why I should join a CSA or why I should invest in a farm. I'm willing to take it as a matter of faith or knowledge or belief, whatever you want to call it, that that's a good thing and needs to be done. And those returns are not just financial, but they are returns to me. I feel rewarded for doing that. And I may actually get some food out of it, or my neighbors may get some food out of it, or somebody else may get some food out of it.
It sounds like something that needs to get moving a lot faster. Slow money, we could use a big growth in it.
I'm aware of that. We're doing the best we can.
Well, some things start as seeds, and then they become waves, and they sweep away some of the old, and the new comes. We can hope. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with Woody Tash. Find him at slowmoney.org. Thank you so much, Woody.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
My thanks to the listeners who chipped in to pay my gas to that Mother Earth News Fair. We ended up with a bounty of interviews with thought leaders in the underground movement to found a new and sustainable civilization. All of these things are seedlings now, I know, but they will grow into mighty things. You can support Radio EcoShock by telling your friends about us and try that Facebook connection too. Feel free to share or rebroadcast any part of this program for free. I'm also asking you to support your nonprofit radio station that takes this message out on three continents. I'm Alex Smith. Let's meet again next week.